Part 4. Significant People in Eileen's Life. Louis Gretzfell. Louis Gretzfell was born on June 28, 1907, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to Robert Gretzfell, 21 June 1879 to the 23rd of August 1942, and Florence Biddle Adams. He had one biological brother, Henry Fell, one biological sister, Florence Fell, and one half-brother, Robert Gretzfell. When Eileen was 20 years old, she hitchhiked to Florida to escape the miserable Michigan winters that she had spent living on the street. There she met 69-year-old Lewis, who had been married before, was a retired yacht club president, the president of Keystone Coal Company, and who almost instantly proposed to her with a large diamond ring. He owned 5 yachts, 7 condos, and could take good care of her for the rest of her life. Once married, the odd couple's picture was printed in the social pages of the Daytona newspaper, where it would not take a body language expert to acknowledge that Eileen looked more compliant than comfortable, even though she had consented to marry a man that was 4 years older than her own grandfather, and was referring to him as Louis. Within 9 weeks, their marriage was annulled, with Louis reporting that Eileen had beaten him with his own cane. He filed a restraining order, but let her stay in one of the condos for 2 weeks before she left, according to her letters to her friend Dawn. She wrote, "This flick was taken in the living room of one of his condos. He had 7, and this one's called the Atlantis in Ormond Beach, Florida. I know if anyone found out how rich this guy was, having as well had 5 yachts in his lifetime, one would say, you should have held on. The reason I didn't was because he was sexually perverted. Once we were married, whereas he felt full control, he began to air it. Only to refuse to wind up beating his ass. Ha ha ha, for sure. From one end of the condo to the other. He's lucky to be alive. Come near to killing him one night. Grabbed a .22 rifle, threw him on the floor, put my foot on his chest and the barrel of the rifle to his forehead and said, I want a divorce within 24 hours or I'll kill you." Excerpt from Dear Dawn, Eileen Wuornos, in her own words. Eileen's first murder would take place in 1989, 13 years later, where 51-year-old Richard Mallory triggered the same rage that she had felt when an older man had taken advantage of her. If Gretzfell was not so wealthy and well-known, maybe she would have killed him. In some reports, Eileen said that he gave her little bits of money, allegedly $30 at a time, which she resented. Within a few weeks of marriage, she had started getting drunk and disorderly in the bars she was frequenting in Florida. Her inner turmoil was evident, and her anger was escalating, while her mental health was deteriorating, something that Gretzfell would not entertain. One has to wonder what perverted requests he had for her to throw her life with him away just to return to the streets and service hundreds of other disgusting men for a fraction of the money. She clearly did not like the feeling of being controlled by a man, rather wanting a life on her own terms, even if it was far less comfortable. Lewis had been married to Catherine Reeves Royce Fell from April 18, 1928 until 1975, with whom he had 1 daughter, then Eileen from May to July of 1976, and later to Elizabeth S. Fell. He died on January 6, 2000, of natural causes in Delan, Volusia, Florida, at the age of 92, 2 years before Eileen was executed. His burial was kept private. One has to wonder if he watched her story unfold once she had been apprehended. Rest in peace, Louis Gretzfell, 28th of June, 1907, to the 6th of January, 2000. Age, 92. Tony. In 1984, Eileen met a woman known only as Tony in Key Largo, Florida, who told her that she was a lesbian and interested in dating her. While Eileen had never dated a woman before, she said that she could not resist her expressing that perhaps this was her solution to finding a committed, sensitive partner who would never leave her or abuse her. "She was a really good friend. I wasn't alone anymore. I wanted to stay with her," she said. For a while, she dreamed of them together without her having to prostitute herself to men, even investing approximately $4,000 into a carpet pressure cleaning business that they had come up with together. However, Tony proved to be nothing more than an exploitative, abusive bitch who took all the equipment that they had bought and left Eileen in the dust with a $425 phone bill and a bedroom fan. She had taken everything else. "I was so upset about losing a business I thought I'd have for the rest of my life." Eileen described to her friend Dawn how much this hurt and that all she wanted was to have her back. She didn't really care about the money or the stolen equipment. She just did not want to be abandoned by her. She said that she loved her even though she punched her in the face sometimes. Yet another toxic, abusive relationship that would not last. They were together for approximately 1 year before Tony ditched her and never looked back. In reflecting on the relationship while on death row, Eileen realized that Tony had never even gotten her a Christmas gift, rather ditching her to spend it with her family, only to return empty-handed. Shortly after being discarded by Tony, Eileen got into a bar fight when a biker guy threatened to beat her up because she looked like a lesbian, where she unleashed her anguish and rage. She said, "If you ever come back to this bar, I'll kill you." But she was outnumbered by biker dudes and essentially ended up being the one kicked out of the bar and told to never come back. Tyria Moore. Tyria Jolene Moore was born on August 3, 1962, in Cadiz, Ohio. Her father was a carpenter and brick mason. Her mother was speculatively a homemaker, and she had one sister and three brothers. She completed high school at Harrison Hills Vocational School, a public school in Cadiz, Ohio, where she had an average academic performance, earning a C grade average. The family had strong Christian beliefs, which meant that she was not able to express her homosexuality at home, especially not in the small, conservative community she grew up in. After high school, she decided to relocate to Florida to find work, to be able to express her sexuality and possibly find love, heading for the bustling city of Daytona Beach. In 1986, she was working as a motel chambermaid when she met 30-year-old Eileen Muñoz at the Zodiac Lounge, a popular gay bar in South Daytona. "She was in there alone, and I was in there alone. We began a discussion, and she ran home with me that night," Tyria said. They became inseparable and had both found the intense, nurturing, and fun relationship that they had been looking for. Eileen said that Tyria was the love of her life and was eventually referring to her as her wife, committed to doing anything to keep her happy. During the 4.5 years that they dated, Ty worked as a cleaner, forklift driver, and had a few other odd jobs, but was more consistently at home drinking beer and cheering Eileen's prostitution on than anything else. Excerpt from Dear Dawn, Eileen Muñoz in her own words. "But she always spent my bread that I'd make, and I never had the chance to, so the next day I'd go out and make more. It was so easy to, and big bucks, all the bars, fancy nightclubs and restaurants we'd hit, as well as her buying clothes for herself. I had one beat up bra, a few pair of underwear, wrecked tennis shoes, 3 pairs of pants, 5 t-shirts to my name. She had gobs of clothes. I couldn't help it. I was insanely in love with her, and I just wanted her to have it all. I was her puppet." Eileen's borderline personality disorder helps to explain her behavior. She would literally do anything, including killing, stealing, and lying to avoid being abandoned. And Ty thrived on her commitment, advising her to expand her client base beyond her regulars to rake in more cash so that they could live more comfortably. Ty said, "We were more like sisters than lovers. However, in Eileen's mind, they were tight like a rope, like a knot, and desperately in love, even though she later admitted in court that sex became unimportant to them after the first year together, and that they were close, like sisters or best friends, who cared deeply for each other. In 1989, they were living in Homosassa Springs, Florida, in a trailer park managed by Billy Copeland and his wife Cindy, who said that they were fairly quiet at first, but later seemed to be more aggressive. Billy said that they liked to shoot pellet guns in the yard, and that Eileen was eventually using her .22 caliber pistol to shoot at a tree, which he asked her to stop. Cindy said that she had asked Eileen if she wasn't scared to be hitchhiking all over the place, and in response, she whipped open her purse and said, "I'm not scared," showing off the weapon that she had concealed in it. Eileen would kill for the first time later that year, and the Copelands now believe that there were signs that the increasing financial pressure and the strain it caused in the relationship had caused her to be more than just a little bit agitated. In 1990, they had moved to stay at the Fairview Inn for $125 per week, but eventually could not afford it and moved into a small room behind the Belgrade, a Yugoslavian restaurant across the road that cost $50 per week. The owner, Vera Ivkovic, said, "Lee says she's lesbian, don't like men, she'd kill all men," and told the media that Eileen frequently shouted at and threatened to kill her husband. She was hooking as much as possible to bring home the cash that they needed to survive, eventually holding men at gunpoint to demand money from them, or murdering them and pawning off their belongings to be able to afford rent. During this time, Eileen was using several aliases, something that Tyria had never done. In one interview, Tyria is quoted saying, "Once I found out she was prostituting, I tried everything I could to have her stop doing that. For one, it's not safe, and then I did care about her, but she never gave it up." However, the evidence proves otherwise. Tyria encouraged and supported Eileen's prostitution because it was easy money and didn't require her to lift a finger. Eileen said, "It was love beyond the imaginable, earthly. Words cannot describe how I felt about Tyria. I thought Tyria must be taken care of, as she herself had never been. The only reason I hustled so hard all those years was to support her. I did what I had to do to pay for the bills because I didn't have another choice. I had warrants out for my arrest. I loved her too much." The pair did not ever manage to achieve a balanced and comfortable life together, rather always hopping from one seedy apartment to another, or staying in cheap motels, abandoned barns, or trailer parks. At one point, they also had three cats, Tyler, Dusty, and Zypher, and a dog, Maggie Mae, to look after, but eventually had to give them up because they just could not take care of them anymore. Eileen said that she and Tyria frequently fought about finances, and that they had one of their worst fistfights over Tyria kicking the dog. Eileen was highly protective over animals, which demonstrates her softer side. She believed that one of the neighbors stole their cat, Tyler, to kill him because they were gay, saying, "Messing with my beloved pets who were like kids to me also fueled the fire within." She was referring to the sequence of events that led to her committing her first murder, where the financial pressure, the thought of being evicted again, losing her animals, and possibly losing Ty was enough for her to decide that she was going to, at the very least, rob someone. "I knew for certain I'd be rolling a client," she said. She also described how antsy she got when she spent nights away from Ty, detailing how she was hitchhiking home and eager to get back to her after having spent a few days in Fort Myers, when Richard Mallory picked her up. Could this be why there was a delay in telling Tyria what had happened to her on her way home, and why she had murdered a man? Perhaps she sucked it up and just wanted to show Ty how much she had missed her before telling her the bad news. Something that the mind is capable of doing when it runs on survival instincts, toxic love, and psychoactive substances, alcohol, marijuana. When Eileen was asked how much Tyria knew about the murders, she said that Tyria was aware of what she was doing, even though she had always insisted that it was in self-defense, and frequently asked, "Got your gun and your rubbers? Make sure that you clean the vehicle out real good if you ever get into any other incident like that." And, using her advice, She usually did make sure to have the vehicles of her victims cleaned before she abandoned them in isolated locations. When the composite sketches of Eileen and Tyria were printed in the newspaper, the Copelands said that they knew it was them, and that it was the first time that they felt scared of them. She had death row written all over her eyes. She was cold, Billy said. According to Nick Broomfield's documentary about Eileen's life, Tyria described her as a fantasist who became jealous and possessive, and who could be violent and frightening. Tyria decided to skip town when she realized that a sketch of her was published alongside Eileen's, and that the risk of her being implicated in the crimes was high. She advised Eileen to throw her gun into the water at Rose Bay Bridge, which she did, and headed home to Pennsylvania to stay with her sister, hoping to lay low until Eileen was put behind bars. However, on January 10, 1991, after Eileen had been arrested at the Last Resort Bar, where the owner, Al Bulling, had said that Tyria loved to win plush toys in the coin-operated machine they had at the bar, she was contacted by police and instructed to return to Florida for questioning. They learned that she was the one driving Peter Seams's car when it crashed, the victim whose body has never been found, that she was in possession of Charles Humphrey's briefcase, and that she had told Eileen that she wanted to know as little as possible about her crimes in case she ever was questioned about them, even though she saw new cars and a variety of possessions come and go every few months, which they sorted out and pawned off together. She was also the one who had advised Eileen to get rid of the gun once the police were onto them. Video footage of Eileen and Tyria in a convenience store together while Humphreys was also in there, unaware of them at the time, leads to a lot of speculation about how deeply involved Tyria could have been. Would an innocent person skip town and then enter a plea deal without hesitation once apprehended by the police? Would an innocent person profit off the stolen items belonging to a hooker's murdered clients? Would they manipulate their partner to confess by telling them that they were going to kill themselves, only to protect their own freedom? Would they betray the partner who took care of them for 4 years by testifying against them in court and then negotiate book and movie deals with the police to make as much money as possible off them? One would think that if you loved someone, even in a toxic relationship, and were in any way involved in the crimes, that you would A, have a conscience, and B, possibly even want to face the consequences together to avoid separation. But Tyria was only interested in two things: protecting her freedom and making as much money as possible from the case. She led the police to the Rose Bay Bridge, where Eileen had tossed her weapon into the water according to her advice. The weapon was retrieved and used as evidence in court, along with Tyria's gut-wrenching testimony against her, where she refused to make eye contact with the person that she was betraying. When the recorded phone calls between them were played in court, Eileen sobbed into her hands and for the first time realized that the one person that she had believed loved her unconditionally, in fact, did not. Instead, Tyria had used a croaky voice, false sobs, and the threat of wanting to kill herself to get Eileen to confess to 6 murders, ensuring that she would emphasize that she had absolutely nothing to do with them. Whether she had anything to do with them is debatable, but how she went about protecting herself was less than compassionate towards Eileen. Note: the police had cleared Tyria as a suspect before they contacted her and coerced her into getting Eileen to confess. "I was very, very scared. I wouldn't have confessed if it wasn't for the fact that I don't want my girlfriend involved," Eileen said. And once her fate was determined, Tyria set out to use her newfound fame and power to profit as much as possible from her demise. While Eileen was on death row, she wrote to Tyria, even sending her handmade birthday cards, drawings, and long letters. But eventually, Tyria asked her not to contact her anymore because she had started a new life with a new woman that she planned to marry, which she did. Yet another request that Eileen honored out of love and respect for her. Tyria's movie deal fell through when she was exposed along with the three police officers involved in the negotiations, which made her become so defiant that the producers of the movie Monster had to create a fictitious character, Selby Wall, starring Christina Ricci, to portray Eileen's girlfriend rather than risking any trouble with her. Eileen commented on the movie, saying that she and Tyria had sipped beer and talked about the relationship ending to keep her out of trouble. They cried, hugged, and said goodbye before Tyria got on a bus and headed back home. The movie also fictitiously depicted Eileen returning to an empty hotel room, screaming in agony over being robbed and abandoned without any warning. She said that while the movie depicted her as someone who hated the holidays, she cherished them but just never had any loved ones to spend them with because they always returned home to their families and did not think to take her along. Instead, she spent the holidays alone in bars, sipping beers and selling her body in the dark and lonely world of prostitution, waiting for them to come back to her, usually empty-handed. In all her time on death row, Eileen refrained from speaking badly about Tyria, instead saying that she missed her dearly and was depressed that she had lost her. In her mind, the biggest consequence of her actions was not her death sentences, but rather the loss of the love of her life. In a letter to Dawn, she said, "I was such a fool, such a waste, wish I never would have met her," which was one of the few times that she expressed her resentment towards her for exploiting and discarding her as everyone else had in her life. At one point, she said that she was furious that Tyria had sold her down the river and that she hated her, but the love she had for her was too overpowering to sustain resentful feelings towards her. She later wrote, "I want Tyria at my funeral more than anything. I'll die thinking of her, as well as you. I don't believe much thought of anyone else will come to mind." One of the final things that Eileen wrote to Dawn about Tyria was, "While so many times I wish I had never met her, yet I still love her to death." At the time of writing, 2021, Tyria is 59 years old and living as a private citizen in Pennsylvania, in proximity to her family. Dawn Bodkins. Dawn Marie Neiman was born on March 8, 1956, 8 days after Eileen, in Detroit, Michigan, 27 miles away from Eileen's home in Rochester. Dawn's family moved to Troy, Michigan when she was 12 years old, where she attended Troy High School, and she and her brother, Ducky, met Eileen and her brother, Keith. Dawn was friends with Lori, Eileen's sister, aunt, and always felt sorry for Eileen, given the state she was in and what she would do for some small change in cigarettes. When Eileen became pregnant at the age of 14, Dawn deeply empathized with her because of how the other kids in the neighborhood were treating her. She became the local untouchable, she said, recalling how much she was mocked, bullied, and assaulted while she was trying to survive her daily life. Dawn was one of the few people who could confirm who got her friend pregnant, saying, "The guy that raped her was like 60 years old, and he loved all the kids. She was drunk, and he'd take advantage of her and shit like that. So that's who she got pregnant by." Eileen had said that the guy who raped her looked like Elvis, but either she had some strong beer goggles on or she meant in the days leading up to Elvis's death. Because of the sexual favors that Eileen was offering some of the boys in exchange for food, booze, and cigarettes, the kids started referring to her as the Sig Pig and other humiliating labels. When Eileen eventually dropped out of school in the 9th grade, Dawn felt sorry for her and skipped class on some days to spend the day with her, eventually also dropping out of school. They spent their days going to the mall, playing pool, bowling, hiking, and drinking. They hung out with other kids in the neighborhood in the pits, which was a remote area with 3 lakes and no houses where they could all drink, take drugs, and party. Even at that age, Eileen was always prepared for the worst, carrying a knife in her purse as they gallivanted around town. "I always knew she'd never let anything happen to me," Dawn said, recognizing the strong protective instincts that Eileen had, which would later get so distorted in a toxic relationship that it ended in serial killing. In 1972, Dawn met David Bodkins and fell head over heels in love with him, which resulted in them naturally spending more time together, something that Eileen resented. At the age of 16, Eileen skipped town and started thumbing her way to Florida. She would only see Dawn again 4 years later at her brother Keith's funeral. After his funeral, she was off again, with his ashes in hand and an unmatched resilience for survival, on the street, on her own terms. On May 14, 1975, Dawn married David C. Botkins. The pair were inseparable since the day they met and lived for 46 years as best friends and 44 years as a happily married couple, having two children of their own, Kimberly and David, and 9 grandchildren, making the most of every day together until he passed away on October 30th, 2019, at the age of 64. David had worked as a plumber alongside his father and later supported his family as an automotive quality technician, and together, he and Dawn bought their dream home and lived a happy life there together. It was a farmhouse with a big yard that would end up also being Eileen's final resting place, right beneath a walnut tree in the backyard. In 1991, police officers had tracked Dawn down after Eileen had been arrested in Florida for murder, wanting some information about her childhood, family, and anything pertinent to the case. Dawn admitted that her first thought was that she was relieved that Eileen was finally off the street, even if it meant being behind bars. At least there she had a bed, food, and more resources than she was used to having, compared to the state she last saw her in. In return for information, Dawn asked the police for Eileen's mailing address, and when they gave it to her, she penned her first letter to her on death row. Eileen eagerly responded, and after 15 years of not being in contact, their friendship was rekindled. Out of all the people that she had ever encountered, Dawn is one of the few who had never betrayed, harmed, exploited, or abandoned her. What started as a few letters every week, written in the evenings when everyone went to bed, became Dawn's daily 5 a.m. ritual. She wrote and wrote and wrote, helping Eileen to get through the grim days spent locked up alone in her cell on death row. "I kept her from going insane," she said. Eileen was incredibly lucky to have Dawn in her life, and the feeling was mutual. "I was one lucky girl to have such a great friend," Dawn said. Their correspondence lasted a decade, with a massive exchange of letters, in-person visits, and then the final visit Eileen had before she was executed. Bizarrely, Dawn was not ever given the opportunity to testify as a witness at Eileen's trial, which her attorneys were heavily criticized for, based on how well she had known her as a teenager and could tell the world about her life and the abuse she had suffered. Dawn helped Eileen to communicate with the outside world, explained the plot of the movies about her life to her, sent her the things that she wanted and needed, and loved her unconditionally throughout her mental health rollercoasters before she died. When the movie Monster was being made, Eileen gave Dawn permission to share her letters with Charlize Theron, who wanted to absorb the person who was both a victim and a monster at the same time. "I was watching Charlize when she was at my house and thinking, maybe she can do Eileen. What made me realize she was going to pull it off was watching her sitting in a chair reading. She cried reading the letters. She was letting Eileen into her heart." Her letters were published as a book in 2012 titled Dear Dawn, Eileen Wuornos in Her Own Words, where Eileen's 10-year span of obsessive letter writing to her friend Dawn, with several letters written to her per day, can be read. It offers another layer of understanding into Eileen's mind and personality, where her sense of humor, charm, open-mindedness, and childlike view of the world can be experienced. Dawn has always described her as having the biggest heart, and without these letters, it would be difficult to understand that she could make jokes, reflect on her actions, keep an open mind, and be an encouraging, uplifting, and generally sweet person. Eileen wrote her letters in neat, beautiful cursive letters on her lined prison paper, with her most common expressions being "for now," "chuckle chuckle," "royal," "for sure," "love ya gal," and "okie dokie." Her letters, while written when she was between the age of 36 and 46, feel more like the bright-eyed expressions of a high school teenager who is full of bubbly thoughts, memories, ideas, and desires. She often reflected on the things she used to enjoy in her freedom, beers, barbecues, shoplifting, being turned on, and rocking out to her favorite songs. Dawn received Eileen's final letter a few days before she was executed, where she expressed her gratitude for the friendship that kept her mind full of life on death row. In the end, she said, "Love you, buddy, and take good care, my friend. You'll be forever remembered by me." Dawn wrote one final letter once Eileen had been executed, expressing how much she missed writing to her and hoping that she was happy in the afterlife before she retired her pen. The last time she saw her was the evening before her execution, where they shared a meal together, hugged, and said goodbye. Dawn said they did not cry because they had been mentally preparing for it in all the years of writing to each other, and they were both happy that Eileen could go to a better place. When asked in an interview how she felt about her friend being such a famous female serial killer, she said, "She doesn't look at herself as a serial killer, just the dictionary does." Dawn's unconditional love, understanding, and effort for her without a doubt had a positive impact on her mental health. Sadly, even with her support, Eileen's mental health had eventually deteriorated to the point where people were debating whether it was ethical to execute her. She had become completely paranoid, psychotic, and delusional. When Dawn was asked in an interview whether she believed Eileen should have been executed, she said she did, based on the fact that she murdered 7 men. When asked if there was anything that could have prevented Eileen from becoming a serial killer, Dawn said, "If her grandmother had lived, everything would have been different. She was the only one who really loved her." Dawn's husband became disabled when he got older, and she has suffered from multiple sclerosis for 35 years. They struggled to pay their bills, and tragically, her husband passed away at the end of 2019. She still has all of Eileen's letters, possessions, art, and photographs saying, "It's been really tough. You know how many times I've wanted to go outside and burn all the stuff? Eileen always said, 'I'm leaving you all this to take care of you, but what am I supposed to do with it? I can't sell it.'" Dawn likely could sell it all based on the high value that crime collectibles have, but does not want to. Eileen gave her permission to sell it, but Dawn values their friendship more than anything and would not want to taint the experience with a price tag, even though she has had to accept money for interviews in recent years to try to make ends meet. Some fans and supporters of Eileen's story have contacted Dawn and have had the opportunity to sit under the tree where her ashes are buried, listening to her favorite songs. Initially, Eileen had requested for her to be scattered on Flagler's Beach in Florida, where she and Tyria used to hang out, but Dawn convinced her that it would be best if she was put to rest in her hometown, away from the victims' families and in a place where she would be with her best friend. Eileen picked the tree she wanted her ashes to be buried under, and Dawn did just that, putting stones on top of the ground to protect them. At the time of writing, 2021, Dawn Botkins is a 65-year-old widow still living in her farmhouse, sometimes without being able to afford gas or utilities, dreaming of seeing her husband and her friend again someday. Arlene Prawley. Arlene Prawley, born on May 6, 1947, was a 44-year-old born-again Christian who lived on a 35-acre horse farm near Ocala, Florida, where she was breeding Tennessee walking horses and wolves when she first learned about Eileen Wuornos. She had been adopted as a child by a wealthy family in Long Island, New York, and had attempted suicide twice before she became a born-again Christian in 1981 and married Robert Prawley, a field engineer for Sony. Wuornos was branded as America's first female serial killer and featured in newspapers across the country, while she angrily sat in prison waiting for her trial to begin. Arlene couldn't help but feel mesmerized by her and wanted to become part of her inner circle, cautiously writing a letter to her as a woman of God who just wanted to help her and give her the love that she had always needed. In Nick Broomfield's documentary, Eileen Wuornos, The Selling of a Serial Killer, 1993, Arlene detailed how she first started communicating with the damsel of death. I read about her in the newspaper. I saw her pictures in the paper, and my dad was in the hospital with a heart attack, and my husband and I had nothing to do but read papers, so we read the papers on her. And as soon as we saw the pictures in the paper, her eyes, I mean, I read people's eyes, and I just knew that she was not capable of being a serial killer and doing what they said. So we prayed for 2.5 weeks, and finally at the end of 2.5 weeks, we reached out to her through a letter. And I told her that she was going to think I was crazy, but that Jesus himself told me to write to her. And she said that when she first got arrested, she went and said, "God, if you are real, send me a Christian woman into my life to befriend me through this mess." So she got my letter, and it was just like an instant explosion. Poof, here's this person. That's how it started. And lots of phone calls later and hundreds of letters later, thousands of dollars of phone bills, here we are. Her husband, Robert, was concerned about the publicity of her connection to Wernos and feared that he could lose his job. I wouldn't think of doing something like this myself, and I was skeptical, but I see her sincerity, the honesty, the love, and I can't fault it, he said. On November 22, 1991, just 10 months after Eileen's initial arrest, Arlene and her husband, Robert, legally adopted her, which Arlene said included changing her name to Eileen Carol Wernos Prawley, assisted by their friend and attorney, Stephen Glazer. They had never had children of their own, and Arlene saw this as finally having the family that she had always wanted after all these years. On Eileen's death certificate, she is listed only as Eileen Carol Wernos, with her mother listed as Diane Arlene Wernos, which should have been Diane Kathleen Wernos, and her father listed as Robert Prawley. But Eileen's name does not seem to have been legally changed, as Arlene suggested in the documentary, which is just one of the many discrepancies found in her narrative of events. In an interview with the press, Arlene said that the adoption was nothing but good old-fashioned Christian love, and that they just wanted Lee to have a family who cares about her and is not going to hurt her. 35-year-old Eileen was only 9 years younger than 44-year-old Arlene, which makes the adoption quite strange, unless the motive was, as Eileen felt it to be, that it benefited her in more ways than was being portrayed. On April 14th in 1991, Arlene had an accident where she got kicked in the back by a horse, which damaged her liver and broke 3 ribs. Her doctor in Gainesville told her that it was the love of God going through her as a channel towards Eileen that saved her life, and that without it she would have died. She clearly had a web of support that shared in and enabled her own delusions, which only made matters worse for Eileen. Thankfully, Broomfield had no interest in meeting with this magical doctor or buying into this miraculous motive that tried to justify the $25,000 they were charging him to talk to them. Once they'd settled on $10,000, Arlene said that the money should be paid directly to her as her mom and that Steve would get a percentage as her agent. But Steve was Arlene's agent and friend, who was later paid by her to suit up and wing it in court to get Eileen executed as soon as possible. In press interviews, Arlene said that when she saw Eileen's eyes in the newspaper, she just knew that she was not capable of doing what they were accusing her of, and yet, her and Steve successfully convinced Eileen to plead no contest to her additional murder charges and earn herself multiple death sentences. Eileen said that Arlene had egged her on to plead no contest by saying that she couldn't take these trials anymore, and that she was killing her new adoptive mom with all these trials, adding that if Eileen pleaded no contest and accepted her fate, the cops would not be able to have information for their movie deals. Arlene said, "Lee's talked about going to Colorado when she gets out, but this is it. I see her here with me," which is an odd thing to say considering that she was sealing Eileen's fate in the execution chamber with vigor. She cruelly toyed with Eileen to the point where she was daydreaming about the life that she was going to have on the horse farm when she knew that this would never be the outcome of her trials. Eileen exchanged letters with her for several months before she realized that she was yet another person in her life who was exploiting her. While she was aware that Eileen was negotiating the price tag for interviews about her, she said that she had hardly received any money from her in all the time that she had known her, which initially included weekly visits, a five-hour drive each way between her farm and BCI, and nightly phone calls to the value of $4,000 in phone bills in 1 year. Arlene said that Lee did not want the money for herself, but rather wanted her to use the money to pay off her farm, which was a projection of her own needs and desires, and certainly not Eileen's. In their initial exchanges, Eileen shared poetry, art, and heartfelt letters with her, even writing, "You are too kind to get to know my kind of mind," and "A friend is one who fights to the end to make things right. Our pact as a friend, cheering you up, never bringing you down, and making sure your life is safe and sound." But by the end, she was speculating with her friend Dawn that Arlene had been so sly and manipulative that she could have even been a relative of one of her victims. She wrote, "She has that adoptive mommy jazz. She's not getting in, because I know she's nothing but some kind of cop, Jackie, victim, or mafia material of some sort anyhow." She also said that Arlene and Steve were giving her suggestions for taking her own life in prison, allegedly eager to see her die, whether by suicide or execution as soon as possible. Arlene said, "The future will be that Robert and I will not have to witness her being executed because Jesus will be coming along before that day ever comes." While Arlene was determined to save Eileen's soul, she was equally determined to harmonize her business strategy with death, even trying to control when that would be to secure her investment and justifying it because she believed that she would be going home to Jesus. It's as if she was pushing Eileen off a cliff for her own good and running to the press with the latest scoop, scripted sales pitch in hand, and of course, all for Jesus. In a death row interview, Eileen said, "Arlene did not adopt me to be my mother. She adopted me to bury me, and she adopted me just to visit and have easier access to visitation." It's interesting to consider that without the pretense of her religious beliefs, Arlene was likely still struggling with depression and projected it onto Eileen, wanting her to succeed in ways that she never did, as morbid as it was. Her saying, "She'd be much better off in heaven, I mean, if I had the choice, I'd much rather be up there, but God has not chosen for me to go, but Lee has an open door here," demonstrates this. At the time of writing, 2021, Arlene is 74 years old and living as a private citizen. In an interview with the media, she said that her horse business was not doing well, that her husband was living in Chicago, 1,000 miles away, and that she was trying to take care of the farm all by herself. Stephen Glazier. Stephen P. Glazier, who was known as Dr. Legal on his Gainesville, Florida TV commercials, was a lawyer and former musician from Florida who was practicing criminal law from his bedroom without a telephone, typewriter, or fax machine when he took on Eileen's case, even though he had no experience in defending a criminal facing capital punishment. He was born in 1954 in Florida and was a self-proclaimed hippie who had practiced music for 10 years after school before he decided to study law in 1983, completing his BA in criminal law at Florida University, Levin College of Law, in 1988 at the age of 33. He was admitted as an attorney on February 15, 1989, just 2 years before the most famous female serial killer in America was arrested at the Last Resort Bar. Steve had been introduced to Eileen by Arlene Prawley, a friend who had hired him to defend her daughter. However, they had agreed that the best way forward would be to convince Eileen to make their path to riches much easier by pleading no contest to her murder charges, with the added benefit of being forgiven by God and going home to Jesus as soon as possible. Steve was more into music, marijuana, and philosophy than he was into criminal law, and it seemed that his only interest was in earning a fat check that could help him sustain his hippie lifestyle for as long as possible without much effort. It seemed to him life was just a stage filled with actors and actresses, and that he was simply cast in the role of a super serious man of law, for which he got his best suit and tie out and combed his afro for. When trying to sell the idea of a $25,000 interview with him and Arlene to Nick Broomfield, he literally said, "It's a fascinating story, because all the characters in the play here are just so very interesting." Unfortunately, Eileen had been so poorly represented by her defense team, which earned her the first of 6 death sentences, that she was open to any suggestions, and naturally, there Arlene was, filled with ideas for how she could better conduct herself in court. While Eileen had dabbled in religion for her whole life, admitting that she even talked about Jesus and politics with her clients, she immersed herself in the Bible on death row, just like Dahmer, Bundy, Gacy, and others had, and soon enough, was eating out of the palm of her new mother's hand. She stood like a little girl beside Glazer as he told the judge that she would be pleading no contest to any additional murder charges. "I think he's a wonderful, honest, true grit with integrity lawyer here," she said. One could visibly observe her wholehearted belief that the judge, who looked pitifully concerned about Glazer's representation, would show her the forgiveness and mercy that her beliefs entitled her to receive when she read her statement in court. When her meek and well-mannered approach earned her nothing but 3 additional death sentences, she realized that she had been royally sold down the river again, and she was pissed. Steve justified his whole charade by saying, "In the theory and philosophy of Jesus Christ, if you are going to believe that you are saved by Jesus Christ, the first thing you have to do is confess your sins. And that's between her and God, and that's what she's doing here." This distancing language reflects that he was merely playing a role and was not aligned with her beliefs. He was simply the chameleon on a stage performing as he had been tasked to perform, even though attorneys usually strive to focus on legalities over philosophies which do not hold up in court. He even put words in her mouth saying that the torment and anguish that she struggled with because she killed 7 men meant that she wanted to die for it, the opposite of what Eileen had ever wanted. What she really wanted was for someone to study her case, get reliable witnesses on the stand, expose Tyria and the police for their corruption, and maybe even tell the world that some of the men she had murdered had criminal records for sexual assault. Steve did not even pick up her case files from Trisha Jenkins and allegedly told her that he was just taking on the case for media exposure. Eileen fired Steve and hired a carousel of attorneys in her additional trials, appeals, and legal procedures before she was executed in 2002. In her letters to Dawn, she shifted between idealizing and demonizing Arlene and Steve, generally distancing herself from them, but keeping enough of a hold on them to be able to ask them if she needed anything. It became much like the trade-off she was used to as a prostitute, whereby both parties would gain something, even if it was not a healthy or fulfilling experience. In an almost premonitory way, Steve said that he was helping Eileen to get executed as soon as possible because that's all that she wanted. After her disappointment in him, that sadly was all that she wanted, and from that moment forward, her entire narrative changed from victim to villain, prodded and poked in encouragement by the people who wore the shiniest halos, so that she could get herself killed without anyone trying to get in her way. Steve was not in the least concerned, smiling into the wind and saying that he would give her the advice that Woody Allen gave in a movie. The lawyer's advice to the client when they get to the electric chair is, "Don't sit down." In 2001, Steve attended Eileen's final appeal hearing before her execution, where her new lawyer, Joe Hobson, would attempt to get her a retrial by discrediting his work. Evidence was presented to demonstrate how Steve had accepted money for interviews to essentially pay for himself when Eileen could not afford to, and that he had not tried to get her a lesser sentence, had not investigated the police corruption, and had not even picked up her case files in preparation for defending her. When cross-examined on the stand, Steve denied setting interview fees or negotiating any agreements beyond what Eileen asked for, which Broomfield's movie proved otherwise. Eileen grinned like a schoolgirl when she saw that Steve had been smoking marijuana on the drive to visit her in prison with Broomfield in 1991, perhaps expecting him to be disciplined or punished in some way. There were no consequences on Steve, and Hobson did not manage to overturn Eileen's death sentences or get her a retrial, mostly because at that point she was insisting that she was a cold-blooded killer who deserved to die. At the time of writing, 2021, Steve is 67 years old and is still the sole employee of his private practice, Stephen P. Glazer, in Crawfordville, Florida. Nick Broomfield. Nick Broomfield is a British documentary film director who was born on January 30, 1948, in London, England. He studied law at the University of Cardiff, political science at the University of Essex, and film at the National Film and Television School in London. Before he encountered Eileen Wuornos, Nick had already created 16 documentary films and won several awards for many of them. He was intrigued by the media frenzy surrounding Eileen's case, particularly when her former lover testified against her in court and sold her out to the police. His 1992 documentary, Eileen Wuornos, The Selling of a Serial Killer, highlighted how many people had exploited her while she was on death row, including her adoptive mother, Arlene Parley, and inexperienced attorney Stephen Glazer. The documentary was used as evidence in Eileen's final appeal in court before she was executed, when Nick was cross-examined on the witness stand about Steve Glazer's behavior as Eileen's attorney at the time. In 2002, he created a second documentary about her called Eileen, The Life and Death of a Serial Killer, where she granted him the opportunity to interview her exclusively, leading up to and including the last day before she was executed. She had declined any other media coverage at the time and only wanted to talk to Nick, which is where the infamous footage of her talking about being poisoned and controlled with sonic pressure in her prison cell originates from. Between 1991 and 2002, Nick had kept in touch with Eileen, even though there were patches of disrupted communication, based on her deteriorating mental health and paranoid beliefs. He interviewed her mother, Diane, her best friend, Dawn, and a variety of people who had been in touch with Eileen throughout her grim life. His documentary not only empathized with Eileen's torturous past, but also made a powerful statement in questioning the morality of executing the mentally insane. He said, "This is the most personal and most disturbing film I have ever made. I knew Eileen over the course of 12 years, and the barbaric nature of her death had a profound effect on me, and months of nightmares. It was one film I didn't choose to make. I came to it as a witness and ended up attending an execution. The violence of taking a life remains the same, whether it is legally sanctioned or not. It introduces murder into our vocabulary or behavior." His way of reflecting on the dark side of trusted figures in society while he cautiously tiptoes through the muck leaves his audience in a state of self-reflection, which makes his documentaries very meaningful. But not everyone was a fan of his work with Eileen, saying that he too exploited her story and that The Selling of a Serial Killer applied to him as well. While he exposed, for example, Arlene Parley and Steve Glazer for trying to make as much money as possible for themselves from the case, paying them $10,000 for an interview contributed to the problem. It's a double-edged sword. He did, however, raise haunting questions about the conduct of her case, which is nothing less than tragic. Broomfield has since created more than 15 award-winning documentaries that have covered the stories of Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love, 1998, Biggie and Tupac, 2002, Sarah Palin, 2011, Whitney Houston, 2017, and more. He also created two feature-length documentary films covering the apartheid regime in South Africa. At the time of writing, 2021, Nick is 73 years old, twice divorced with two children. May he still have many years ahead of him as a fantastic documentary film producer.